I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from Dubai, the main target after Israel, Lebanon, and Iran of the U.S.-Israeli war in West Asia. We enter the fourth week of so-called Epstein Fury ahead of tomorrow's forlorn UN Security Council debate on the Middle East. In a week's time, Trump was supposed to be in China. Not now. Trump's not going anywhere. What began as a U.S.-Israeli sabotage attack exploiting Kushner-Witkoff fake negotiations has turned into not just regional chaos here in West Asia, but slow-motion destruction of the people's livelihoods in NATO nations. Not just energy, but all Trump's wars, concomitant impacts, annihilate the security of everything, from food production to medicines to chip production. Here, we live under the threat of Iranian attacks on key Gulf infrastructure, including desalination plants that produce much of the water in this region. So far, it looks like the U.S. president is more enthralled in Netanyahu blackmail and Miriam Adelson's money than billions in investment from the Gulf, the threat of the end of a U.S. presence in the Middle East, and November's midterm wipeout of the GOP as Trump's base turns against him. That's all, let alone Trump's massacre of hundreds of young girls with a double-tap tomahawk strike and the environmental destruction of the Gulf as oil tankers are hit in the Strait of Hormuz. Tucker Carlson calls today's guest one of the most informed people in the United States who can speak freely about what is happening. Brandon Weikert worked in the U.S. Congress and consulted for the U.S. Air Force before becoming senior national security editor in 1945. He fears Netanyahu is pressuring Trump to go nuclear, meaning the first use of nuclear weapons in battle since 1945's Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The author of A Disaster of Our Own Making, How the West Lost Ukraine, and The Shadow War, Iran's Quest for Supremacy, joins me now from Naples, Florida. Brandon, thanks so much for coming on. I think I know why
it's
the
an
violin
honor to be here.
I know why the violin's in the background. I better preface the fact that your book, The Shadow War, Iran's Quest for Supremacy, is certainly no fan of Iran. Normally, I think I'd be quite critical of some of it in there because you sound like a neocon to some. But let's get cut straight
well,
to the...
Okay, I just correct you there. The reason I wrote that book was to write a third way between invasion and surrender, which was the Abraham Accords. And obviously, that's completely off the table now because we've completely gone off the deep end. I never was advocating war in that book.
But, no, that's okay. True. Exactly. You don't advocate for war in that book. But you have said, and you warned us all since the 12-day war, actually, that this war was coming. Just how would you characterize... Yeah. Iran's escalation right now, the escalation strategy, because I suppose that's what everyone's thinking about right now.
Yeah. Well, I would actually, and again, as no supporter of the regime in Iran, I would tell you that the Iranians have been very methodical and actually judicious in the escalation. They have not actually escalated on their own. They have always counterpunched. So the Americans and Israelis, as you noted, we initiated this fight on February 28th, against the best judgment of the U.S. military Joint Chiefs of Staff. The president wanted to do this because he was convinced this would be 72 hours to 96 hours, one and done, and then the people of Iran would overthrow the benighted regime. That did not happen, and now here we are 3 weeks in with no end in sight. The Iranians have escalated only after we, or the Israelis, have. You notice they didn't start attacking things like the oil refineries until after they really started getting hit in those target areas in Iran. And so what you're seeing is a very graduated escalation program by the Iranian military. Clearly, they have gamed this out for a long time. This has clearly been the game plan from the very beginning because the Iranians studied the American and Israeli ways of war, and they knew decapitation strikes would be coming in. So they decentralized their regime. They decentralized command and control capabilities. They went underground like Mao did during the Chinese Civil War or the North Vietnamese did during the Vietnam War. They very adeptly created an insurgency, a high-end insurgency profile for fighting the Americans and the Israelis. And now they're tethering it to economic attacks, which is brilliant because they know that the Americans and Israelis are far more, and the Arab states, are far more exposed to economic disruptions in the aggregate than are the Iranians, who have been sanctioned and contained for so long. It doesn't affect them the same way.
Yeah, but you have high-level sources. I know you can't tell us them in the Trump administration. Did you not phone them and tell them all this before that?
They don't take my calls. They haven't taken my calls in a long time. That's occasionally they'll reach out to me, but I was put on ice almost from the beginning. And one of the theories among my friends is because I was not on board with an invasion strategy. I mean, I was supposed to be brought into the Pentagon for space policy, but that didn't happen because I wasn't fully fledged committed to what you're seeing now. This has clearly been on the books for a while, this war.
But
it's unfortunate, too, because
they let J.D. Vance become vice president. Trump chose Tulsi Gabbard as the director of national intelligence. That can't be true.
They've isolated Tulsi quite effectively.
But they still appointed her.
Yeah, but she has no real power. She's basically hermetically sealed right now in her offices. And then JD is out there carrying water for the president, which I'm actually very surprised by, to be honest with you. I thought this would have been his moment to break out and start charting a course for what comes after President Trump, because we're at that point now, because the war has gone so badly for the Americans and the economy is doing so badly right now. It's only going to get worse, that there's no way, you noted this in your monologue, there's no way the GOP survives the midterm. And if that happens, Democrats take power, they're going to impeach Trump as soon as they get sworn in.
I should just say we're recording this before either Vice President J.D. Vance or the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, resign or leave office, just in case happen.
Right.
In your book, you said in your book, which was written obviously a long time before the current conflict, you said
back in 2021 was when the original manuscript ended. I sent it in, so 2022 is when it came out.
And you said one misstep in its dealings with Iran could produce a nuclear third world war. I don't know whether you were surprised that Trump seemed to, for the first time, concede that Israel has nuclear weapons in the Dimona program, which you might want to tell me about that, because that's a first from the Americans. What did you mean, a nuclear third world war there?
Well, basically what we're seeing here, and I would also point out in that book, I predicted the 10/7 attacks, not exactly, but I knew this was coming. The Americans do not understand that for the Israelis, who they're very closely tethered to, the Israelis, this is an existential fight. The Israelis have convinced themselves this is a Holocaust in waiting, and they have to prevent it, and therefore they will go to whatever extremes they must do in order to end the what they perceive to be as the threat from the Iranian regime. And that includes if the chips are down, and it's looking like Israel's not doing well right now, if the chips are down for Israel, and America seems to be getting a little tepid about the war, not by much, but there's some tepidness here, they're going to start looking at potentially escalating in the nuclear domain. And I think they're not there yet, but I do think we're now in the real possibility phase where this down the line, if the war doesn't end soon, that's where this goes.
Yeah, on the heels of Mordecai Vanunu, the whistleblower, there was Seymour Hersh's book, The Samson Option. We actually had a source on who is Seymour Hersh's source, ex-Israeli intel, Ari Ben-Menashe. Yep. And of course, we went viral with that because he was saying that Trump is being blackmailed into this war by Netanyahu. What did Trump mean when he told the Times of Israel the decision to end the war would be mutual? What does he mean by that? And is that a symptom of that?
Well, let's be clear here. I don't know for sure what they have on him, if they have anything. I don't know. What I will tell you is, even if this were totally above board, the fact of the matter is we now know that the decision to initiate hostilities while the president gave the order, the timeline was not his own. Marco Rubio and many other sources, both in the U.S.
You're referring to Rubio saying that
Rubio's statements, they tried to roll it back a little bit, but the British government has also, representatives from them over the last week, have also said this was basically an Israeli timeline that we just followed. And so on some level, because we are so, and this is the real problem here, because the U.S. government, especially under Republicans, is so tethered to the Israeli agenda, we can't pull out even if we wanted to, because let's just say Trump wakes up tomorrow and he tacos out. I'm done. I'm out. I've done everything I wanted to. The problem is that might actually put the Israelis into a use it or lose it mentality, and they'll start popping off the nukes. And that is the concern here, I think, among some people in D.C., is that even if we wanted to quit, first of all, the Iranians aren't going to necessarily let us quit right now. And second of all, our partners, who we are basically in hock to, the Israelis, are not going to want this to end.
Now, obviously, information is key in any war. Well, I understand already John Ratcliffe's CIA is involved in different programs. I mean, you're made even more famous, obviously, because of your appearance on Tucker Carlson, and Tucker Carlson is claiming that he is the subject of a CIA investigation. That would be John Ratcliffe targeting him. What's with the CIA artificial intelligence disinformation attacks?
Well, as somebody who's been subjected to those disinformation attacks, I can only tell you
it's because... You have to explain them.
Yep.
It sounds like a conspiracy, of course. It does sound like a conspiracy. Yep.
Well, it is a conspiracy, very, very
technically.
But it's real. It is real that you see this on Twitter ever since the war began, these bot armies. You saw it during the Ukraine war. At least in my case, it's the bot army attacks. It's clearly Langley and probably Israel. But ultimately, they target journalists and public figures who have a high degree of knowledge and access, who are sharing things that are counter to the narrative. And I think Tucker is, I mean, this is not the first time he's been targeted by U.S. intelligence, famously during the Putin run-up to his Putin interviews. So this is something that our intelligence community, and really the nexus of Five Eyes intelligence community plus Israel, they do to people who are dissidents like myself, but also who have a high degree of currency with the political class in D.C. And Tucker's the same way on a much bigger level than I'll ever be. But that's, I think, what's going on here is they're very concerned that people like me, people like Tucker, people like Joe Kent, former National Counterterrorism Center director, we're speaking out, not because we're pro-Iran, but because we're pro-America. And it's very clear this war is not in America's best interest. And it's also very clear that the American government did not entirely execute this war on its own accord. In fact, you have this now where the U.S. intelligence community has maintained Iran was not even actively producing nuclear weapons, which, whether you agree with that or not, that obviously was never taken into account, because you have Caroline Leavitt, the official White House spokeswoman, saying that on one hand, the threat was imminent. The president's saying that he was 8 to 10 days away from nuclear breakout. And then Caroline, 3 days ago, a week ago, says, actually, there was no imminent threat. Now, again, today or in the last week, she says, oh, no, the threat was real. They can't get their story straight. And I think that's why you're seeing these attacks on people like me and Tucker, because our story is the truth. And we're telling it, and it's a straight line.
Brandon Weikert, I'll stop you there. More from the senior national security editor at 1945 after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the author of The Shadow War, Iran's Quest for Supremacy, Brandon Weikert. Brandon, you were talking at the end of part one about Trump's director of the National Counterterrorism Center. He said, I cannot in good conscience support the ongoing war in Iran. Iran posed no imminent threat to our nation, and it is clear that we started this war due to pressure from Israel and its powerful American lobby. I think he's a friend of yours. What would you have to say about Joe Kent's resignation?
I think Joe Kent is an honorable and incredible American. I think he's probably the most prominent war hero of the global war on terror years. Obviously, famously, not only did he sacrifice his time and effort over 25 years, but he tragically lost his first wife, Shannon, in Syria, who was also an incredible patriot and American. And then her loss was significant both to the intelligence community and to our country, and obviously to her children. So I think that Joe did. So Joe basically, and I haven't spoken to him since he resigned, so I don't have any, you know, special insight here, but I believe that Joe had access to intelligence related to what was going on. And I think that he could reasonably read the tea leaves just based on his many years of experience, and he realized that the administration had committed itself to not only a bad course of action, but I would argue an unconstitutional action. And I think he's seeing where this could potentially go, likely go. I think we're talking seriously behind the scenes about putting ground forces or trying to put ground forces in the coastline of Iran. I think that there's discussions of escalation. Clearly, the president no longer believes in his golden off-ramp. So I think Joe's looking around and hearing what he's hearing from the inside, and he's saying, I can't be a part of this. I've already lost my wife to something like this. And it's the same thing. And he says it better than I can in his resignation letter, where clearly it's Israeli interests that are driving this. And you're hearing this, by the way, from multiple people now, many of whom, again, that are not pro Islamic Republic of Iran, people like my friend Sam Faddis, who was a former many years long CIA case officer, actually trained Joe's wife in counterterrorism methods. So you hear this from actual national security professionals saying, we don't like the Iranian government and we think they're at war with us, but there's a way to go about this. And what we're doing is the absolute wrong thing. And it will actually harm America at that strategic level. It will have very serious negative impacts for us and our children and the world economy. And we have to stop it. And that's what all of us are trying to do who actually know what's going on. The problem is Trump has surrounded himself with grifters and CPAC D-listers. And all these guys just want to get on Fox News and want to get the gushing love of the president. And that's what you're seeing now. He's not getting any inputs from people who actually know what's going on in the world to give him an off-ramp to say, this is a bad idea. This is the end of your presidency.
Trump, for his part, said his own director of national counterterror, Joe Kent, after he resigned, never knew anything about security.
Yeah, I think the president's comments were disgraceful. And I say this as a three-time Trump supporter. I think he was disgraceful. I think that he should immediately walk back. He won't. He should walk back those comments. And I think that everybody in the administration and the GOP who's attacking Joe, I think they need to remember that there's an entire community of national security professionals and veterans in this country who fought the global war on terror, and they're not going to like what they're hearing because it's a pack of lies and it's shameful.
Well, anti-Semitism has become part of that project. It'll obviously be important to smear anyone who talks like Joe Kent as an anti-Semite. Also, yeah. What'll be important for the ground invasion of Iran will be casualty figures so far. You've been saying that you don't really believe the United States' official casualty figures of this war in Iran so far.
No, I don't. I think everything this administration has said about this war is a disgusting lie. I think that it is, like I said, an unconstitutional action, the way that we got into this. And I think that if they're lying about they can't even figure out why they went into war. They're not giving us the official reason. I think in this interview, you and I have gleaned that this is probably not in America's interest. This is in the foreign interests of Israel. If they're going to do that, and they're going to now risk a possible ground war in Iran, however, quote unquote, limited, and we're going to possibly risk letting Israel go off the chain and cack off a nuke somewhere, I can believe they're probably lying about those casualty rates. I hope I'm wrong. I have a lot of friends in the military. I have a lot of connections to the U.S. military. I hope it's only 10, I think 7 or 10 people so far they've officially said have been killed. 200 plus have been wounded. But normally, when you have 200 casualties in a situation like this, it's a matter of simple arithmetic and statistics. You're going to have more than 10 dead, at least 30 to 60.
But how would that work? And the servicemen and women, their families in the United States surely would say their relatives are missing?
Normally there's a media blackout. There are ways the Defense Department or the War Department now, what a horrible name, that they go about sort of getting families to comply. And I'm not going to get into all that here because I don't know if that's what's going on. But usually, yes, there is a way that the DOD goes about making sure they have operational security over things like casualty figures. It can't last forever, though. And that's another thing. I think what you're seeing is a very sophisticated attempt to sort of slow walk, not to totally cover up, but to, instead of at once or within a few weeks release all the damage assessments, they're just kind of cherry picking and slowly releasing. That way it doesn't drive the news cycle the way casualty figures, for instance, did in Vietnam. That's what they're trying. This is all a media management strategy. It's a perception management issue. And the DOD is very good at that.
Yeah, you implied that the War Department isn't a good name. I'm sorry. I'm with Pete Hegseth on that name change. arguably, many people are. But I mean, also the casualty. Fair. I mean, those casualty numbers obviously clearly are part of the propaganda effort. But then, of course, we have to come to the issue of false flags because the American people are not with this war.
No.
You know, the Lavon Affair, USS Liberty, Northwood, Gulf of Tonkin, famously. I mean, what sort of false flag will be required to induce a ground attack? Because clearly, even the slowest of walks is not going to make the American people happy.
Well, if you just go back to 9/11, and you go back to the Gulf of Tonkin, you know, go back to some of these instances where
we don't know 9/11 was a false flag, in fairness.
No, I know, and I was getting ready to correct myself. But just say instances or events where there's clearly more going on than what we're officially told that trigger a wider response, kind of an emotional response. The risk is that there's a terrorist attack, either another 9/11. Michael Yon, who's a war correspondent, has said to me he thinks someone's going to cack off a nuke somewhere in Texas, a dirty bomb. I don't know if it's going to be like that. It could be like 10/7, where it's sort of the sweeping run-and-gun series of terrorist attacks in the heartland. We've heard threat assessments in the last year indicating that could be a possibility, and they're going to say it's Hezbollah or Hamas or something Iranian-related. The fact of the matter is, and this gets back to what we talked about in the beginning, the Iranians have such a very firm, it's actually very impressive, control over this escalation ladder. It wouldn't be in their best interest to do a string of terrorist attacks right now in the U.S. Do they have the capability? Absolutely. They have the largest consulate outside of Iran is in Mexico City. That's not because of all the Shiites that are living in Mexico. It's because they're probably conducting covert operations on a massive scale here in the United States.
I'm not exactly sure of that, I've got to say. I mean, I should say I lived in Iran. Far be it from, I remember the rubbish about Hezbollah on Margarita Island in Venezuela.
Let me just complete the thought here, and you can push back. But my point here is I don't believe that the Iranians would be crazy or stupid enough to risk solidifying American public opinion behind the war. Because the Iranians are savvy enough to know there's nowhere near a majority of people who support this. And all the polls the president are being given, we now know Susie Wiles, the chief of staff, has basically been paying off any of the pollsters that would have done honest polling from the right. She's paid them off so that they don't do honest polling. And I'm not going to name names because I don't want to get sued. But I know that this has happened in the last 8 months. And this was precisely for this moment. So she's feeding the president bad polls. And then also you have the issue of it's not in Iran's interest to actually put the fear of Iran into the minds of the American people. It doesn't make any sense to do it right now. Iran is winning this thing at the strategic level, and they know it. So if there is a series of terrorist attacks, we have to really question, is it really because the Iranians are crazy, or is it because maybe there's other factors at play here, other intelligence services that want us to get more fully on board? There's an Israeli assessment floating around. I saw it, not going to say how, but there's an Israeli assessment floating around in the last 2 weeks where basically the Israeli intelligence services concluded the only way to basically right this ship is for the U.S. to land Marines at some point along the Iranian coastline and to try to conduct sea control operations along the coastline. And the Israelis assessed that under current political conditions, the U.S. administration will not commit to it. Now, I think they might, but the Israelis don't believe it. They think it's very questionable. And without that issue happening, without that happening, they don't believe they can, quote, win the war. So then that gets us into the theories of could it be a false flag on our way to trigger American support for a ground incursion?
I mean, clearly what you're saying is catastrophic as regards future American
casualties.
This is
the greatest self-inflicted wound. This is the greatest self-inflicted wound since Vietnam. And it's also, by the way, the greatest self-inflicted wound for Israel. This makes no sense. Furthermore, if you're living in the Arab countries, you're probably thinking of the Kissinger line that to be an enemy of America is dangerous, but to be a friend is fatal. I mean, just look around you. And this is all because the U.S. and Israel decided to engage in an unconstitutional, probably illegitimate war against an enemy that we could have contained like we did to the Soviet Union without ever getting into a fight with.
Yeah. I mean, no fundamental changes yet, but we are actually safe yet. We haven't been destroyed yet here.
Well, that's good.
Dubai,
I'm praying for you guys.
But clearly, from Iran's point of view, they have to destroy the U.S.-Israeli threat forever. That's their avowed reason for their tactics at the moment, reflecting in a way what Israel is saying the other way. How can Iran achieve that? How can they destroy the threat forever?
Well, I think Pezeshkian, the president of Iran, has made a comment, and I'm going to paraphrase now, so forgive me, but I think he said it to one of the Arab media outlets. He said that we in Iran have to give the Americans such a bloody nose that they never try something like this again. Again, to me, that's not crazy. To me, that's a very realistic and graduated assessment of how to go about deterring and stopping and deterring future attacks by the U.S. and Israelis. So what they're going to do is continue to increase the costs economically on the United States and its partners, so much so that we basically buckle under the economic and therefore political strain, notably going into the midterms. And that basically forces us to disengage, if not negotiate a full peace treaty, which I think, by the way, I think ultimately, if there is an off-ramp, I think that we're going to use Putin to negotiate as an intermediary with Trump and the leadership of Iran, if there is an off-ramp to this thing, that it's not going to see the return of U.S. power in the Middle East ever. It'll be a very diminished presence at best. And I think Israel will go back to being sort of a contained entity the way it was, you know, in the 1970s and 80s, because the Arab states, they're never going to want to, you know, get close to Israel again, and they're going to be looking for a third way. So I think ultimately it's not necessarily total destruction of Israel and the U.S. unless things keep escalating. I think the Iranian view is we just have to bloody them so much they know that if they ever try something like this again, it will put them into the Great Depression. And that's really, and it's, again, it's a very smart strategic outlook. And we completely misread and misunderstood, and I would argue probably I misunderstood as well when I wrote the book, the full threat of the region, or just, the full view of the region.
Just finally, and I should say that MAGA would go for that reduced presence in West Asia. But just finally,
oh, I'm all for it. It's just how it's happening.
Yeah, exactly.
Like Afghanistan, it's how it's happening.
Yeah. Off the dead bodies of so many men, women, and children. But just finally, then you mentioned a possible Putin summit to sort this all out. You are an expert on the NATO proxy war on Russia through Ukraine as well. Russia has won the war in Ukraine as a side effect of this?
They've basically, the only real winner geopolitically is Russia. And you're witnessing the collapse of American superpowerdom in real time, not the rise of China to replace us. Oddly enough, at least for now, Russia's going to be elevated by all of this. They're going to benefit from high oil prices. We've already removed the sanctions on Russian oil. They're going to be galvanized. They will get everything up to Odessa. They're going to dictate terms now. And ultimately, the United States is going to be a declining power from here on out, and Russia and China are in the ascendancy.
Brandon Weikert, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to all those bereaved by today's NATO nation wars of aggression. We'll be back on Saturday, continuing coverage of the Trump-Netanyahu war on Iran. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.